From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, writers and NPR news analysts David Brooks and E.J. Dionne discuss civil discourse and Wisconsin as a political laboratory. Then Michael Pollan has been excited about the local foods movement, but concerned as well.
I realized at a certain point that this very exciting movement to reform American agriculture and create alternative markets and an alternative food economy was going to top out if people weren't going to cook anymore.
And Jerry Polin explains what first led him to write travel books about oddball destinations.
It started because I wanted to get away from the Chicago Cubs, believe it or not. I lived in Wrigleyville, and one day the crowds were coming for a day game, and a friend of mine and I just said, we got to get out of here. So we headed up into Wisconsin, started looking for strange things.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today. David Brooks and E.J. Dionne disagree with each other for a living. Brooks is a columnist for the New York Times, generally with a conservative view of things. Dionne writes for the Washington Post, typically with a liberal bent. The two appear regularly on NPR's All Things Considered and offer their analysis of the week's events. But despite their often differing take on politics, the two are more than cordial to each other. They are friends who manage to disagree without raising their voices in anger to each other. That relationship made them the ideal speakers at the gala dinner for the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum, which was marking, in its words, a century of civility. I had a chance to interview them on stage at that event. We talked about Wisconsin's place in national politics, but also how they're able to maintain a friendship amid political disagreement. David Brooks answered first.
Well, we actually secretly hate each other, but we're good actors. I have a rule of who I'll be on with. I'm on NPR with EJ, and I'm on a show called The News Hour on PBS with Mark Shields. So I appear only with Catholics from Massachusetts, and that works for me. EJ and I have been long friends. Mark and I have been long friends. Mark has been doing the News Hour for a long time now. Our segment is called Shields and Brooks. We wanted to call it Brooks Shields, but they wouldn't allow that. And before that, it was Shields and Chigo and Shields and Gergen. And then before that, it was Shields and Coolidge. And it started out as Shields and Thomas Aquinas, I think. And E.J. and I have known each other for a long time. And we met, well, probably through work, but we have a lot in common. Baseball. We both have sons who played pretty serious baseball, and we used to commune over that. We're similar height. That's important. I'm not sure how. Mostly it's just, when you're going to argue with somebody, first you want to like them. You want to have a relationship. And then you want to, I used to be a liberal, and I can talk about why I came to my senses later. But you want to have some respect and know that politics is basically a competition between half-truths. And each side probably has a piece of it. My side is just a little larger.
E.J. Dionne.
David and I both love Theodore Roosevelt. David loves him because he's a conservative. I love him because he's a progressive, which probably proves that both of us are wrong. I honor the Gill family in the room. And it does reflect the fact, this organization reflects something that doesn't happen that much, and it's something David and I talk about. Which is facts matter in public policy, but they don't seem to matter so much in the debate right now. And I think David and I sort of share a sense that at least we ought to share, some sort of basic agreement on what the facts are, and then we can beat each other's heads in. I grew up actually in a conservative family, although my family became more liberal over time. I once inscribed a book to David's mother which said, who raised a wonderful son and has much better politics than he does. But I always like to say that I grew up in a very argumentative extended family. And so I can literally say I deeply loved people I passionately disagreed with. And you don't have that much. And one of the favorite things that's happened to me is I had a dear Uncle Ray, and he and I spent 35 years arguing about politics. And his kids, my cousins, were kind enough to ask me to do the eulogy. And I made a point in the eulogy of quoting Richard Nixon. And it was a Nixon quote I actually liked, but I looked at the people in the room and said, you know, the other reason I quoted Nixon is because I was hoping Uncle Ray would come back to life, rise up out of the casket, and point to me and say, I knew you'd be quoting Nixon someday. And I just think that there is a sort of an odd degree of hatred in our politics now. And look, I can get very polemical, and I can get angry myself, so I don't pretend to be an angel on any of these things. But there is just something about not understanding the possibility that somebody might have a different view from you. And I think that's sort of what brings David and me together, even though he's wrong on most things.
Well, and you talk about friendship, and you talk about youth baseball, and I wonder if you're onto something here. Not everyone has kids in youth sports, but at the heart of things, there are commonalities that tie us together that are maybe overlooked. We tend to think of each other as proxies for liberal or conservative and not proxy for woodworker or jogger or bowler. I mean, is there something about not even being interested in getting to know each other anymore?
Yeah. Could I just say real quick on that? It's
already interrupting me.
Yeah. One of the issues I think we most agree on, we both share an interest in community. We discovered maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that we both liked a conservative writer called Robert Nisbet, who wrote a book called The Quest for Community. And David's politics are closer to Nisbet's politics than mine are, but there is this sense that, communitarianism, it's not a great word, but it's a great idea. And I think that David has a communitarian streak in his conservatism, and I have a communitarian streak in my liberalism. Go ahead, David.
Most of us in the course of our lives have shifted, so you're aware of other positions because you used to hold them. As E.J. mentioned, my parents were pretty left-wing. And I remember in 1965, they took me to this be-in. I told this story. E.J.'s probably heard it. I was five. A be-in was where hippies would go just to be. In New York, and
most of this audience experienced that.
Probably, if you were in Madison, I guarantee it. The hippies took their wallets out and they threw it into a burning trash can, and to demonstrate their liberation from money and material things. And I was 5 years old, and I saw a $5 bill on fire in the trash can. So I broke from the crowd, reached into the fire, grabbed the money, and ran away. And that was my first step over to the right, but it took a little while. I should say, since EJ's currying local favor, I am a member of one completely socialist organization. I am a co-owner of the Green Bay Packers. I would say one thing, too, just to your question. Tom Wolfe was once asked, what's the most important thing that happened in your lifetime? And he said, oh, that's easy, co-ed dorms. And I think what he meant by that was that the decisions politicians make have huge effects on how we live. But the most important effects are changes in community, changes in morality, changes in attitudes. It's about sociology and psychology and romance. And if you take politics as a small piece of life, then it's hard to have an absolutist hatred towards somebody when you probably share things in these other realms.
Well, let's talk specifically about Wisconsin, which I think we can agree has been the model of civility. This state, along with Ohio and Indiana to a degree, has been at the leading edge of what seems to be a growing political will to take on public workers and public worker unions. First of all, what do you see as the ripple effect nationally from the politics that has played out in Wisconsin, particularly since Scott Walker became governor?
Go ahead, David.
EJ wants the rebuttal position on this one. One of the things that's been striking to me is that we, each generation has an incentive to spend money on itself and make promises to itself and push the costs onto future generations. And no generation has done it to the extent that we have. And I have theories about that or why we've done that, but we've made huge spending on ourselves, huge promises to ourselves, and pushed the costs on others. And that's through deficit spending on the federal level, and that's often through state's pension spending on the local level. And so to me, that is a legitimate big problem. It is also a problem that is going to take decades to get out from under. And therefore, as you're doing the problem, solving it, you have to acknowledge that the other party exists. And you have to find a way to respect that they are going to exist, that they're going to be in power, and then if you're going to have try to set a series of bipartisan policies, you have to acknowledge you want some continuity from party to party. So you have to think in terms of bipartisanship. So I totally understood why Walker went after some of these issues. I think it's essential for governance in the future. It's going to be essential in Illinois. It's essential in California, state after state. You have to go after these unaffordable pensions, which are just sucking up money from everything else. But where I differed from the approach I saw here was that you got to create a long system that's going to work across parties, and I thought he was needlessly confrontational.
E.J. Dionne, is it that it's a problem at all, or is it the aim that was taken to the problem?
Well, I think you can sort of sense some of the differences in the way David and I look at the world by where he began his discussion, which is that the central problem is with the deficits and looking to the next generation. And I think the central problem for the next generation is the lack of economic growth and the rise of a kind of radical inequality where we have gone back after a period of narrowing inequalities, a long period of narrowing inequalities in our country. Inequality has grown steadily since 1973, and we became we were about as unequal on the eve of this great recession as we were on the eve of the Great Depression. I don't think that's entirely accidental. Therefore, when I look at what happened here in Wisconsin, my view of unions is fundamentally positive because I think when you look at how we became a great middle class nation, unions played a very large role in that. They played a very large role in guaranteeing a decent level of life for people who worked in blue-collar jobs. And so I had an instinctive reaction against the direct frontal attack on unions. I would agree with David, for example, that pension costs are a problem for a lot of states. I think the real cause of that is that a lot of politicians found it easier to put money in pensions that were hidden in the future than to give public employees direct raises, and that was a problem in both parties, and now we have to come to terms with that. But when you look at Wisconsin, as if I'm right, that Bill 10 excluded cops and firefighters, and here in Milwaukee, I think 68-69% of pension costs are in for police and fire. And I honor police and firefighters, but that seems more political than it does a real attack on the problem. And the politicians I admired in the downturn were the ones who, A, were willing to make cuts necessary, but also willing to raise taxes because they didn't want to do it all in cuts rather than simply go at spending. And I think it's a job of politicians to negotiate with public employees rather than to try to take them on by force. And so I found, I would have been clearly on the other side of this fight here in Wisconsin.
The fight vaulted the former Milwaukee County executive turned governor onto the national political stage. Many are describing him as a national political contender now. What is your assessment of where Scott Walker falls in the Republican presidential or potentially vice presidential field in 2016?
I think it's not out of the question in the sense that he does have a lot of sympathy on the Republican right. Just the enemy or your enemy is your friends, and a lot of people on the right these days dislike unions. I also think that some of it will depend on the mood of the party because a certain amount of a kind of confrontational right that has not seemed to help them in presidential elections. And another thing I find curious that I've learned about is, this effort to have state law tell localities that they have to get rid of their residency requirements. It just seems odd for a conservative to tell Brown Deer or Milwaukee or La Crosse that they can't do something that was traditionally allowed and, not to mention taking those property taxes out for people who collect public pensions. And so I think, when you're a governor, I picked that one issue when being governor is great preparation for a presidential campaign. It can also be disastrous because you've got to defend an entire record. And Mitt Romney couldn't defend his greatest achievement as governor. He should have embraced health care in Massachusetts, and he couldn't. So there's a real challenge these days, and I think some of it is the media environment, to being a governor and going on the national stage.
Yeah. David, I would say it's harder to be – I mean, to get the nomination, it's easier to be a governor. I mean, between John Kennedy and Barack Obama, 61 senators ran for president, and their record was 0 for 61. And I used to tease them, why do you guys all lose? And they would say, well, we take tough votes. But the reality was, and this was given to me by one of the senators who ran for president, is we're United States senators. We don't like staying in the Motel 6 in Pocahontas, Iowa. And they're sort of puffed up and distant. And if you're a mayor or a governor, you actually do talk about issues that are concrete and real. And so I still think governors have an advantage. Nonetheless, when I look at the political the presidential candidates at this early stage, I just look at them like a baseball, a pitching scout. You just look at their stuff. Who throws the best fastball? Who throws the best curveball? Who has the best speaking style? Who has the most charisma? Who's best one-on-one? And so my exterior view, and I've met Walker a few times, is that he doesn't have as good stuff as a lot of the others. Marco Rubio seems to be a better politician. Paul Ryan seems to be a better politician. Just who's good? And I would put him in the middle of the pack.
Maybe he could reinvent himself as a knuckleballer, though.
We have a lot of knuckleheads. I don't know if we have
Let me ask this question, speaking of the economy. As sequestration's effects find their way further and further into people's lives, who stands to pay a political price as we head toward the midterm elections?
First of all, the biggest problem with sequestration, there was a very good piece in the New York Times today on how foolish the policies we are now following are. The Times piece, if you didn't see it, said that austerity, kind of pulling back at this moment, has probably bumped the unemployment rate up by close to a full point. That's a lot of people without work who don't have to be without work. We're not out of the woods yet on the economic crisis. We are growing. It's better than it was. But we should be doing all we can to speed growth along. There's a time to address deficits, but it's not when you're still coming out of an economic mess. And the sequester just contributes to that, and not to mention creating particular problems. And I found it disturbing that, the flight delays hurt people who can afford plane tickets, so we'll fix that. But we're not going to fix Meals on Wheels, and we're not going to fix cutting Head Start, and we're not going to fix the cut for the unemployed. There's just something fundamentally wrong with that. But whether you agree with that or not, even if you don't agree with that, the policy of cutting at this moment is just a terrible idea. The problem is, I don't know if there is going to be a big price paid, because I think the Republicans, they believe in cuts, and they made a calculation that in the end, a slowing economy is likely to hurt the president and therefore the Democrats. And I think a lot depends on how these issues are argued between now and then. The president, I think he's got to bring us back to the larger debate over what it takes to build an economy. And some of that does involve, and I know I'm not using it as a euphemism for spending, investment. Including investment in infrastructure for the long haul. That's one issue David and I actually agree on. And so I think a lot depends on how the issue is framed.
Well, here's where we disagree. We've been borrowing $1 trillion a year plus for 5 years now. We're still borrowing close to $1 trillion a year. If this was austerity, I don't know what non-austerity looks like. We're just borrowing a lot of money.
Yeah, except the deficit is down much lower than that
now. Yeah, we're still, historically, the deficits are hugely high. And so I think if you take a look at the growth levels and the spending levels, there's really little correlation. Obviously, government spending creates some growth. I think the effect of that is remarkably weak and depends a lot on the psychology of the country at any given time. I think the sequester is too small an effect to have much an effect on economic growth in an economy, whatever it is, a $14 trillion economy. Nonetheless, I hate the sequester. It was designed to be stupid policy, and this is one thing Washington did magnificently, stupid policy. And I hate it because it does none of what you want. I mean, to me, what I want to do, and let's talk about something E.J. mentioned earlier tonight, which is he mentioned the inequality, and I agree, that is a gigantic problem. I think we have two gigantic problems facing the country on the economic front. One is the rising inequality across educational lines. One is rising debt. And so to me, the way you deal with both those problems simultaneously is spend a lot more on discretionary spending now, on Head Start, on infrastructure, on early childhood programs, on all sorts of job training programs, and then do entitlement reform by means testing Medicare and other things over the long term. In other words, we have a government that's a giant machine for taking money from struggling families and giving it to affluent seniors. And what we should do is have a whole series of policies to take money from affluent seniors and give it to struggling families. And so to me, you can sort of solve both those problems. The sequester magnificently does the opposite. It cuts all the domestic programs that go to struggling families. It doesn't touch Medicare, basically. And so it hurts all the wrong people. It helps all the wrong people. And it makes our government much more like the kind of government you would have if your nation is in decline, spending on the present and not on the future.
First of all, I just want to go back, David, on one thing. I mean, broadly, I am sympathetic to the idea of transferring some resources from the wealthy to families who need them. I think that there's this notion that if there are all of these millionaires hanging around in country clubs collecting Medicare and Social Security, most of the spending on the elderly goes to elderly people who really need it. And a lot of the problem is not the elderly, it's rising healthcare costs. And, you know, the good news there is we may actually be succeeding in bringing down healthcare costs for the longer term. And if we can do that, a lot of these other problems become much easier to solve. But I, again, this is probably an area where David and I disagree. I think that there are some savings to be had in those programs, but I don't think they're as great as David says because there just aren't that many rich elderly people to take this money from.
As much as it pains me to say this, the time has flown by, and more of it has flown by than initially planned. But before we wrap up, please let's give a warm round of applause and thanks to David Brooks and EJDN.
Thank you.
David Brooks is a columnist for The New York Times. E.J. Dionne writes for The Washington Post. Both are regular pundits on NPR's All Things Considered. They were the featured speakers at the Public Policy Forum's 100th Anniversary Gala Dinner last week, where our interview was recorded. You can hear more of the conversation at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A quick break now, and in just a moment, writer Michael Pollan on why the local foods movement requires a revolution not just in the grocery store, but in the kitchen as well. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Michael Pollan is no stranger to the murky world of food production and how we humans fit in the chain, starting with the omnivore's dilemma in which the writer explored the farms and feedlots where our food is grown. Pollan later examined what the food we eat does to our bodies. In his new tome, Cooked, he takes the art down to the bare bones to educate himself and readers about the kitchen. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz met up with Pollan recently as he visited Milwaukee during a book tour. Pollan says he's hoping the excitement he experienced rolling up his sleeves will inspire more home cooking. He calls it a healthy recipe for family, farmer, and community.
I realized at a certain point that this very exciting movement to reform American agriculture and create alternative markets and an alternative food economy was going to top out if people weren't going to cook anymore. Because the food available at the farmer's market, with the exception of the fruit, all needs to be cooked. And the great thing about this new food economy is that it is changing the proportion of the food dollar that ends up in the farmer's hands. So if you buy conventional supermarket food or processed food, 92 cents of that food dollar goes to someone other than a farmer. The person making the packages gets more than the farmer gets. But if you're shopping at the farmer's market, joining a CSA, buying local food even at your grocery store, 80-90% of the food dollar is ending up with the farmer. So I realized this revolution was going to stop unless people cooked. And then on the other end, as I studied nutrition and saw that nutrients really don't explain a healthy diet, and nor do calories even, and that the most important thing about the diet was who's cooking it. And that was the most significant fact about your diet. You could, in effect, assure a healthy diet simply by cooking whatever you want. I mean, there's a Paula Deen exception in there somewhere, but you always need an exception that proves the rule. So the nutrients take care of themselves. You know, if you're going to cook, you're not going to make French fries for two meals a day. It's too much trouble. It's too messy. You're going to tend to buy the best ingredients you can afford and prepare them fairly simply. And that's really the key to a healthy diet. You know, eat food, not too much, mostly plants, and cook it yourself.
The research went on for years, as you mentioned. When did it come to you, the way that you wanted to lay it out, the fire and the air and the water?
You know, what I do in all my writing is try to look at something in its most elemental terms. Cooking, as I looked at it, I found that there were these four transformations, and they happened to correspond to the classical elements, more or less. I did a little shoehorning. Fire is the most unreconstructed primordial kind of cooking, is basically putting meat on fire. And then there was water, which is cooking in pots, which comes much later. It's only about 10,000 years old only. But that changes everything. That gives you a whole new way of cooking. You can combine plants and meat. You lose none of the nutrients. It's incredibly economical. Whereas if you're cooking over fire, things drip in the fire and you lose all that fat and good stuff. Plus you're softening grain. You can suddenly now eat grain, which is a big boon to humankind. And it allows you to keep old people alive because people without teeth can now eat. No, it's true. Presumably, way back then, when you lost your teeth, you were dead or close to it. And it also allows you to wean babies earlier because you've got this mush that you can prepare in pots. And then air is baking. And the technology of bread is really an important technology for the history of civilization. You can't survive on flour alone. But if you turn it into bread, you create something that you can live on. And the reason is that the baking process and the fermentation process releases all the nutrients, all the minerals, breaks down the starches in ways that make them very digestible. So it's an incredible advance. You know, it's the difference between porridge, say, and bread is night and day, because in a pot, you can only get things up to boiling point. It's as hot as it'll get. But bread creates its own pressure cooker. And in all those little balloons of air, you have steam, and you're getting up probably to 300, 400, 500 degrees. And so you can thoroughly cook the starches and make something really healthy. And then last is earth, which is what I call the transformation known as fermentation. And the reason I use earth for that is that, like the soil, it's a process of microbial breakdown. And the earliest ferments were just pits, where people dug pits, put their food in it, covered it, and you could get through the winter that way, because the fermentation is a form of preservation.
Part of the buzz that a buzz that I've heard is that, egad, Michael Pollan wasn't a fabulous cook from the get-go.
I was a pretty ordinary cook, actually, from the get-go.
Give us an example of pre-alchemy.
I would make, you know, pasta. I would buy pre-made raviolis and, you know, put a little sage butter sauce on. I was very proud of that dish. But the point is, I was a very thoughtless cook. I just did it. I'm much better than I was. I can do things I could never do before. I can make bread without looking at a recipe book just from feel now. You know, I've done it enough. I can make very nice braises and things I thought were very ambitious. You know, the word mirepoix scared me for a very long time. And now I'm very comfortable with a mirepoix, which is that dice of onions and carrots and celery that we turn into the base of a, you know, French dish.
How does one encourage people to step away from the microwave or to get out of the fast food line? Where to start?
There's a lot that stands between us and cooking more than we do. We are, as a culture, outsourcing it progressively. And we're getting a very powerful marketing message telling us it's too hard, we'll do it for you, we can do it better. All I'm doing is offering a contrary narrative. It's not so hard. It's incredibly satisfying, and it has enormous benefits. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, it's pleasurable. Whether you regard cooking as drudgery or alchemy is all in your head. And we've been encouraged to think of it as drudgery. And I thought of it as drudgery. I thought chopping an onion was one of the worst ways to spend 15 minutes I could think of, you know, short of going to the dentist.
And that was because why?
Well, it's you know, it's hard to do. Peeling is difficult. The thing that and the onion's fighting back. It's making you cry. It's slippery. I mean, the whole thing just was not fun. And but as I learned what was happening, you know, and I spent a lot of time looking at the science of onions. How do they make us cry? What is that mechanism? Why are they doing it? And I learned some good knife skills from some of my teachers. And suddenly what had been this annoyance became a kind of Zen practice. And I stopped fighting it. And I started, you know, I had my little mantra, when chopping onions, just chop onions. And that's about as Buddhist as I've ever gotten. A lot of this is in our head. Now, I don't want to trivialize the real-time problems people have, because they do have real-time problems, and both partners are working in most households now in America, or at least 60%, I think. It is a challenge, and we have very busy lives. But there's a couple things I would encourage people to ask themselves about that. We always say we're busy, and it's automatic, and it's just kind of who we are. And we do find time, though, for things that we think are important. In the last 10 years, we found about 2 hours a day to surf the internet, do our email and everything. 2 hours that we found somewhere, because the day is still 24 hours long. We took some of it from television watching. That's gone down. And we probably took some of it from cooking. And I don't know where else, from our sleep. I don't know. But we find time to go to the gym and the yoga class, because we know it's really important to our health and our sanity. I'm just saying that spending that time in the kitchen at the end of the day is equally important to your health and your sanity.
Here in Milwaukee, and I know other cities, one of the terms thrown out there is food desert. On the other hand, we have the Will Allen Growing Power movement. We have a growing number of community gardens. And yet there's lots of people thinking, oh, hey, how do we achieve a time when everyone has the kind of food that they can prepare in their kitchen or a kitchen? You know, how do you bridge those gaps?
Well, look, there's no question that individual choice, voting with your fork, is not going to solve all the problems of the American food system. We're going to have to vote with our votes, too. We're going to need changes in policy to make good, healthy food more accessible to more people and make it more competitive with junk food. Because right now, you know, our farm subsidies support the growing of corn and soy, which are the building blocks of processed food. That's the basis of high fructose corn syrup for soda and soy oil for frying fast food in. And we're doing very little to support diversified farmers. And we're doing very little to support the growing of fresh produce. So we need to address that. But the food desert issue is a very interesting issue. And there is research suggesting that it isn't always the problem, that there are many places where there are supermarkets and the diet is still really lousy. And there's still a lot of pressure toward fast food. And by the way, there's still a lot of crap food in supermarkets. So there's no guarantee having a supermarket is going to fix your diet. And I think what we're finding is that many people in these so-called food deserts lack the skills, even when they have access to fresh produce. And it's not just poor people, it's everybody. We have a generation that wasn't taught by their parents how to cook. There are people who don't know the first thing to do with fresh produce. If you talk to people who work in food banks, you know, they're giving away a lot of processed food and maybe they should give away fresh produce. I've talked to people involved in these programs in California. They get the fresh produce into the food bank and aside from fruit, people don't know what to do with it and it rots in the refrigerator. There is a food desert problem, but there's a kitchen literacy problem too. And that I think we need, in addition to giving people access to food, we need to give them access to the skills to prepare food. And that food security depends on knowing how to cook. Nothing fancy, how to roast a chicken, how to saute some vegetables, these some really basic skills, you know, things that you could do with a knife, a cutting board, and a cast iron pan. And that we need access to those tools as well as to the fresh produce. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, we use this term fresh produce and seasonal eating and everything. One of the great things that the food industry has given us is frozen vegetables and canned vegetables. These are forms of processed food that only have one or two ingredients and are great and inexpensive. You know, we talk about the elitism of the farmers market, and if your concern is about health, you shouldn't wait till you can get organic produce. I mean, any produce is good for you. The benefits of eating vegetables outweighs the risk of pesticide residues by an order of magnitude. So I think we have to pay attention to the food access piece and also the food skills piece, because I think they're very closely connected.
So are you out to change the world?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm out to change the food system, but the food system and the world overlap in a major, major way. Is central to the environmental crisis. It's central to climate change. It's central to the public health crisis. And it's the biggest part of the economy. I think we need to take control of our diet. I mean, that's kind of the implicit politics. It's a personal political message. But I found that to the extent I learned how to do things for myself, even things, you know, extreme things like brewing beer, which I learned to do in the course of this, you know, I'm not going to brew all my beer, but the fact that I know how to do it makes me feel a lot more competent, a lot more independent. And once you've learned to insource some of these so many things that we outsource in our lives, it's very empowering. You could even bake a loaf of bread when you want to. You're able to imagine all sorts of other changes in your life. I think one of the things that's stymieing us politically is this sense of we can't imagine changing anything. We're so dependent on the world as it is and the market as it is. And that if we can build this space of competence around ourselves and do a little bit more for ourselves, I'm not saying everything, I'm not saying all the time, but almost in a ritual way, I think it suddenly opens up. You can imagine living with less fossil fuel, a lighter carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. And that feels really good. I think there's some political and even spiritual reasons to get involved in becoming a little bit more of a producer and a little bit less of a consumer.
Are you about to announce that you're going to open a culinary school?
No, you could do better than learning from me. No culinary school. But I think, you know, I've thought a lot about, people have been asking me, you know, well, how do I learn how to do this? I don't know how to do this. Being in a room with someone who's cooking and watching them and helping them speeds up the learning process really dramatically, because so much of it is understanding how the onions in the pan should look and smell when they're ready to move to the next step. So is there someone in your circle who cooks something you really like, who's passionate about making pie or baking bread or makes great soups? Ask if you can come help next time they're doing it. And people will be flattered to be asked. And I think it'll speed your learning so quickly. And if you are a good cook, take somebody in. We need to be trading these skills. This is such an important part of culture, is how do you prepare things? And some of us have it and some of us don't have it. And we need to share it.
Michael Pollan is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and his most recent book, Cooked. He spoke with Susan Bentz during a recent book tour. He's posted what he hopes are helpful FAQs and useful links, which we have a link to from our website. Pollan also recommends checking out YouTube for some top-notch how-to in the kitchen videos. His next project involves diving into microbiology, specifically the fermentation that takes place within our bodies.
So I've been learning a lot about that, and I just had my gut microbe sequenced, and I'm learning what is that ecosystem? And so that's where my interests are right now. We'll see where that goes.
Keep listening. From Pollan to Poland, writer Jerry Pollan spotlights Wisconsin's weirdest tourist attractions in a new book. That's When Lake Effect Returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. If you came of age more than a few years ago, you probably remember the time when a vacation included a stop at a, shall we say, dubious roadside attraction. Places like the Mystery Spot or the Alligator Rodeo used to be commonplace along the roads and highways of America. They're harder to find now, but fortunately, writer Jerry Pollan has done the hard work and assembled many of Wisconsin's unique attractions in an updated version of his book, Oddball Wisconsin. Pollan lives in Chicago, but he joined us in the studio recently to give us some suggestions for an oddball tour of our state. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
You have authored a whole oddball series of books about different states. Is Wisconsin any weirder than any place else?
Oh, definitely.
I mean, you're just saying that.
No, I mean, if for no other reason, the Wisconsin Dells, you know, those, you know, sort of this vortex of weirdness in the upper Midwest.
This is a new edition of a book that was first compiled 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. And at the risk of adding serious cultural significance to this interview, you write that things have disappeared from the landscape in the interim, and there are other oddities that are on the endangered species list.
Absolutely. And sometimes they're, you know, you don't find these in large cities anymore because of the property values. You have to go out into the field and look for these things, and with the exception of the Wisconsin Dells where they seem to assemble. Most of the places, you know, you should see them now or you likely won't see them in the future.
So how did this subspecialty of travel writing happen to become your specialty?
You know, it started because I wanted to get away from the Chicago Cubs, believe it or not. I lived in Wrigleyville, and one day the crowds were coming for a day game, and a friend of mine and I just said, we got to get out of here. So we headed up into Wisconsin, started looking for strange things. I had a guidebook that was not very helpful, didn't have any addresses. We got lost. We only saw a few things. And I thought, you know, this is the kind of thing I'd like to see. And it became this obsession for me. And anytime something happened in the news or I heard about something on TV or on the radio, I would jot notes down. And now I've got huge filing cabinets, one for each state, where I'm throwing in information all the time for places to visit.
And being in Chicago, I would think that doing the Wisconsin field work would be pretty easy.
Oh, yes, yes. And you can get to the weirdness sooner by going up into Wisconsin than you can going downstate into Illinois.
What makes a really good – you know, what makes something jump out at you that makes you want to drive there?
Well, I think there has to be some sort of passion involved. I mean, the sites that I really enjoy, there has to be some sort of passion. Like there's this guy by the name of James Frank Katera who's up in Lake Nabagoma up near Superior, Wisconsin. Since April 3rd, 1975, he's been winding a twine ball. And he did it because he gave up drinking and he decided, I'm going to do something productive with my time. And he started building this twine ball. And it's not like wrapping it around and around in circles. He winds these things in and out and twists them around. It's actually beautiful when you get up close to this thing. And it's maybe 9 feet tall and about 12 feet wide. It's sort of like a large jelly bean. It's not so much of a ball. It's all these different colored twines from hay bales and blues and greens and yellows and reds. And they're all twisted down. It looks like the surface of a brain. And when you touch it, it's very squishy. But this guy just pulled up. He's out there. He's working away like he's been doing it for 30 years or I guess 40 years. And, you know, that passion is the sort of thing that I really can appreciate. And it's not really a typical tourist attraction. You know, there's not an entry fee or anything like that, but he's always there and you can go visit with him.
Right. It seems like the kind of thing that would be unlikely to plan a weekend around, but if you're in the area, it makes for an interesting hour.
Absolutely. It's worth going out of your way for.
He must be – he's kind of kindred spirits with Fred Smith, who the mastermind behind the concrete park.
Right, up in Phillips, Wisconsin. And he built about 230-some concrete statues after he retired from a life of logging in and around this bar that he ran. And many of them were damaged back in the 80s, and they were restored by the Kohler Foundation. And now you can go visit Fred Smith's Wisconsin Concrete Park. And there are these figures that are all embedded with glass and tile work. And they have some of his friends. They've got salutes to baseball teams, and he's got an entire Clydesdale team.
You mentioned the Wisconsin Dells. There's a whole section of this book on the Dells. And it is an area that was probably developed with this kind of book in mind. But what jumps out at you even within the craziness that is the Dells as especially odd?
But by far and away, that's an easy question to answer. It's called Top Secret. And what it is an upside-down White House. It looks like somebody has taken the White House, turned it upside down, and dropped it. You go inside, and everything is on the ceiling. Not just the furniture, the drapes hang up. There are George Washington is standing on the ceiling, and as you're going from room to room, they explain what this is, but it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. You eventually end up through all these caverns down in a a laboratory where they're building this robotic Obama. And, you know, they're just making all kinds of corny jokes. And, you know, you meet Bill Clinton's there and he's got stumps on his arms. And they're like, well, why, where are his hands? Well, he couldn't keep his hands to himself. So just corny jokes
and
like that.
And it's all upside down.
Everything's upside down. So you're walking on the ceiling and they're standing on the floor and they're upside down. And it's very confusing. And I didn't quite figure it out, but I did enjoy it.
There are also a lot of locations in this book that are really just locations. They're not even necessarily marked. But you would say it's enough to know that stuff happened there?
Oh, absolutely. I'm trying to think of an example.
Orson Welles' birthplace in Kenosha.
Oh, yeah. Orson Welles' birth. We got birthplaces that we don't know about, like where exactly Frank Lloyd Wright was born. There's like seven sites that lay claim to this, and only one of them seems to be accurate. But yes, I do.
I was interested. No such dispute exists in the Daniel J. Travanti birthplace,
but that's
apparently up the street from Orson Welles.
And Al Molinaro.
Oh, right.
Yes,
right.
It was also from Kenosha. Yes.
There are some little known roadside plaques. I was interested in the part of Madison where Elvis Presley apparently broke up a fight between two teenagers in 1977.
Yes, it was 52 days before he died. He'd came into town. It was 1 a.m. His limousine pulled up along Washington Avenue and he saw these two guys beating up another guy. He jumped out of the limousine, ran over there, gave him sort of a karate stance, and the fight stopped and he got everyone to shake their hands. He got back in his limo and took off. Well, believe it or not, somebody has commemorated this site with a little headstone, and it explains it all on, you know, it looks like a tombstone headstone. But it explains all of this event on this tombstone, and it's in a little park. You know, the park is maybe 4 feet by 2 feet,
carved out of a used car lot.
Yeah, right? Next to a used car lot, correctly.
Well, and so let's talk about some of the other places that are maybe very close to home for people who are listening to this. I mean, starting in downtown Milwaukee, I can see one of them from by just craning my head at my desk. The Ladybug Club is in this book.
Right. These large ladybugs that are crawling all around on the outside of this building across the street. If you go one block in the other direction, you can see Gertie the Duck. Gertie was a duck that had some eggs that she was hatching in the very waning days of World War II, and people had enough of the war, and they were very interested in Gertie's brood. And they stopped construction on the bridge over the river here. And today, now there's a monument to Gertie the Duck on the end of the bridge.
What else do you think is odd and maybe less well-known in Milwaukee?
People who attend Marquette probably know that the Joan of Arc stone is in the chapel there on campus. And supposedly this was a stone she was at before she was burned at the stake. And reportedly, if you touch it, it's colder than the other stones around it. And we go there today and you can test it out for yourself.
Have you tested this out?
Yes, I have. And it does seem to be colder. I'm not too superstitious, but you can't argue with the temperature.
Tell me about the concept of acrobatic goats. There's a really compelling picture in this book of a goat apparently going down what looks sort of like a zip line.
Yes. Goats, and I didn't realize this. I even though I grew up in the country, I didn't grow up on a farm. Goats love to climb. And they have over in Spring Green, there's a Peck's Farm Market. They have a little pen where these goats, there's towers, and towers are connected by these teeny little ramps. And if you put food into a little canister that they have a clothesline that you can pull it all the way up to the top of this tower. And then the goats go up to one tower and across the little ramp, up to the next tower, up to the next tower, and all the way up to the peak to get this food from you.
How much of what is in the 2013 edition was in the original?
I would say maybe half. There's quite a bit that's new in the book. It went from about 200 sites to about 400 sites. One of my favorite new sites, though, is a place called Rocks for Fun Cafe in Tigerton.
And I have no idea where Tigerton is.
It's sort of up near Green Bay,
okay,
but a little bit west of there. There's a guy by the name of Don McClellan, and he had this cafe, and he started making these little puns built out of rocks. So it would be something like the coffin rock, and it has a little coffin with a rock in it that's dead, with little dead eyes, with little X eyes. It's spelled cough, like C-O-U-G-F, and it has a little
– C-O-U-G-H probably.
C-O-U-G-H. And it has this dead rock and a little poem about why you shouldn't smoke. And there are about 322 of these things at the time this book went to press, and he's got 160-some on the drawing board. You can go on his website and look at this. And this guy is like Henny Youngman. He goes between the tables, and he pulls these things off the walls, and he shows you these little, you know, they blow up in your face or, you know, they bounce on a spring. And it just goes on and on and on. When I stopped by there, I was the only customer, and it was at full attention from Mr. McClellan. But it's definitely worth going out of your way for.
Take my rock, please.
Yes.
So going beyond the border of Wisconsin, what are some of the other kinds of really interesting places that you have come across recently or maybe in Wisconsin?
Right now I'm working on an Oddball Michigan book, and I'll be up there next week. One of the things that I found up in Michigan, and it's at their historical museum, but I didn't realize it was there until I turned the corner and there it was the baby grand piano that Stevie Wonder learned how to play at the Michigan School for the Blind. And they've taken this baby grand and they put it in a display about the Motown sound, and even though that baby grand was not from Motown.
Well, very good. Jerry Poland, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jerry Poland is the author of a series of books on unusual tourist attractions, the latest of which is Oddball, Wisconsin. He's also a book editor, and he lives in Chicago. He joined us recently before a reading at Milwaukee's Boswell Book Company. That's Monday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.